loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Catalan President Puigdemont has gone to Belgium, along with several other Catalan officials, following the announcement of heavy charges against pro-independence leaders. Meanwhile, the central government has declared that a new regional election will take place in December. Next, longtime leader of the Kurdistan regional government, Masoud Barzani, has resigned following an independence referendum that prompted an Iraqi government offensive that retook the contested city of Kirkuk. Following clashes in the Kurdish parliament, what comes next for the KRG and Iraq? Then, another round of Syria peace talks convened by Russia, Iran, and Turkey are underway in Astana, with delegates set to discuss the future of the country's four de-escalation zones. And finally, some of the most revealing documents in the JFK files were in fact about Cuba. Evidence has now emerged that the U.S. government was considering biological warfare on Cuban agriculture and a staged bombing campaign that would be blamed on the Cuban government, among other schemes. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear.
But first we turn to Catalonia. Catalan President Puigdemont has gone to Belgium along with several other Catalan officials following the announcement of heavy charges against pro-independence leaders. Meanwhile, the central government has declared that a new regional election will take place in December. We're joined again from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Welcome back, Dick.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
Well, there's different reports in the American media. Puigdemont fled. Maybe Puigdemont has gone to have meetings. We don't really know what's going on, but what's your take on it? How do people in Barcelona and Catalonia feel about this?
What we know, and it's not much more than what you just said, but what we know is that he's gone to Brussels, five ministers have gone with him to Brussels, and that the plan, according to one of the MPs for the pro-independence camp here, is that he make a public announcement, televised announcement, which will be an appeal to, I imagine, European democratic public opinion. And then we do not know if he's going to come back to Catalonia and face all these charges, which are very, very serious charges and take up to 30 years jail, or whether he's going to look for exile in Belgium. This, we just have to wait and see. I mean, we should say that Belgium, while they have towed the line so far with the European Commission and the European Union on not recognising Catalonia, have expressed much more sympathy, and there is real sympathy for Catalonia in Belgium. So what the upshot of all of this is, I can't say, and nobody else can say at the moment. But the basic strategy of Puigdemont and of the leadership is to just keep making the issue of the democratic right to self-determination of the Catalans as heard as widely and as possible, and that put Madrid on the spot. So I think we'll just get more and more of that debate in more and more circles, and what will happen to Puigdemont will be maybe a sort of secondary thing, because with these elections coming up, everybody, all the parties are going to stand from all parts of the spectrum, with one exception maybe of the People's Unity List, the left, the radical left independence people, who will make their decision on Saturday.
Dick, the Belgian asylum minister, a man by the name of Franken, is a member of the Flemish Nationalist Party called the New Flemish Alliance. It has close ties to the Catalan separatist movement and indeed has been very supportive of it in the press over the last few weeks. He made a statement saying that Puigdemont is absolutely welcome in Belgium, that his visit to Belgium is 100% legal. In the event that Puigdemont decides to stay in Belgium, and I'm just asking you to speculate here, what does that mean for the movement on the street in Catalonia? It would presumably then be leaderless. So what happens then in Catalonia?
No, because what is going on at the moment is, of course, that there's organization of an alternative. Well, I don't know who the people are, but there's certainly a plan B. You know, there's a second layer of leadership. I mean, they've been thinking about this for a long time. They also have the experience of Catalan history to go on, which was the Catalan Generalitat, that's the Catalan government, was in exile for 40 years, maintained itself in exile for 40 years under Francoism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really sort of chicken feed to what they had to go through then. So here it would not be seen of, you know, rat, look at him running away, leaving us here. It wouldn't. I don't think that there'd be some people who see that, but the general feeling of independence people is, pro-independence people would be, well, if he thinks he's got to be there, that's probably for the best, and we await instructions.
Well, what then happens if these are sedition charges that he and others are facing from the Spanish government? Spain is part of the EU. Won't Spain then appeal to the EU to extradite Puigdemont and the others if they're facing serious criminal charges? Is there any obligation within the EU rules to do just that?
I don't know at all very, very in detail, Brian, but I know that under Europol, which is the European Police Confederation or network, you know, that any charge that is made in one EU country by police in one EU country is followed up if the suspect is in another country. But of course, that's not going to happen automatically because of Belgian politics. I mean, what happened with the Minister for Immigration, who's, as you said, is from the Flemish part of Belgium, he said, oh, well, Puigdemont would be welcome here and he'd be safe here. But he was overruled by the Prime Minister. Not that the Prime Minister is hostile, quite the reverse. But, you know, Belgian politics being what it is, you know, where they go for a year and a half without a government and it's endless negotiations between the Flemish side and the French side, between the left and the right. It's all, you know, it's even more complicated than politics in the Spanish state. It's just not easy to say what would happen. I don't think there will be people in the Belgian government who would just kick up a huge fuss at Puigdemont being delivered back to the Spanish state.
Dick Nichols, can you explain to our listeners what we should expect with this December regional election that has been called for? Should we expect those who support Catalonian independence to boycott this election? Is there any reason why they would want to participate in it?
No, this is that's the question. The questions you've asked there. Rapidly, the answer is no, everybody's participating with the exception, as I said, of the People's Unity List, that's the radical left independentist force, who have 10 seats at the moment. They are obviously thinking, what's happening is people think the immediate response is, the gut response is, we should have nothing to do with this. This is just part of the intervention from the state, 155, under Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution. But almost immediately people say, but what would it be like if the pro-independence forces boycott this election, hand all the state, all the ministries, and effectively power over all the work that's been done in Catalonia to preserve and develop, you know, Catalan education system, culture, and all the other gains that have been made in the Catalan welfare, despite being in a Spanish state. What would be the effect of handing that over to a bunch of unionists, especially a party like Citizens, which thinks that the problem with Spain is that it's not just Spanish? You know, the problem is nationalities. We just got to wipe them out, effectively, you know. So that's why Pedicat, the right nationalists, so the Catalan European Democratic Party, which is Puigdemont's party, they've already said they're going to stand, and they've said they've got the support of Puigdemont for standing. The secretary said that just now. The centre-left, Republican left of Catalonia are standing. The non-independentist left, the known as the Commons here, like Catalonia in Common, associated with the mayoress of Barcelona, Ada Colau, they're going to be standing. So that would leave only the CUP not standing. And so I think what's going to happen, the big discussion is going to be, what way should we stand? What coalition do we stand? The unionist forces are already talking about having a deal amongst themselves. So the pro-independence forces will be forced to work out how to run this campaign. One idea that is floating around is that the campaign be led by the two leaders of the mass movement who are in jail, the two Geordies, Jordi Sanchez and Jordi Cuixart, who are, you know, arrested 10, 12 days ago now. And this would be like the sort of old Eugene Debs campaign in 1919, you know, vote for prisoner 1576. So that's all this is up in the air at the moment.
You know, Brian, the Spanish newspaper El Mundo published a public opinion poll this morning saying that in the event that the pro-independence parties do stand, and it appears that they will stand in this election, that they would lose their parliamentary majority with 42.5%. Which seems to me, and Dick, please jump in, which seems to me like it would throw this entire thing into turmoil, as if it's not in turmoil enough.
And also, Dick, if you might mention that the charges against Puigdemont, these heavy sedition charges, also came at the same time that there was, at least the pictures I'm looking at, very huge, massive demonstrations over the weekend in Catalonia, in Barcelona, for unity with Spain. Talk about who were those hundreds, it seemed like hundreds of thousands of people. Who were they?
Okay, take that question first. This is the unionist camp here, the unionist sentiment in all its bits and pieces, which runs from the far right, Francoist fascists, through to the Socialist Party. This was a big mobilization, but it wasn't it was 300,000. So here we get used to mobilizations of a million. They claimed a million, but that the municipal police, who are very accurate on this thing, said no, 300,000, 350,000. That's still a big demonstration, obviously. Basically, what is happening is the last election, the unionist forces got 39% and the pro-independence forces got 48%, and the other slice to make up the 100% was to Catalonia, Yes We Can, which is the left force, which is a bit independence, a bit pro-independence, a bit federalist, a bit confederalist. It covers all these people, all different positions on the national question. Since then, sentiment has been going up and down for and against independence. What is happening here is that given the experience everybody's had of it, heightening tensions, especially provoked by the attacks on the Spanish government, on the Catalan government offices on the 20th of September, and then the referendum, the day of the referendum, and all the violence associated with that, is that you're getting a polarisation. And what Rajoy and the central government is betting on is that they can mobilise people on the unionist side who normally don't vote in Catalan elections. You've got a funny thing here, which is that the vote in Catalan elections the participation is much less than it is for Spanish national elections, Spanish elections. And that's because a lot of people who can see themselves as Spanish, when Catalan elections come along, they say, oh, well, that's not for me, that's just Catalan elections. You know, what I vote for is in Spanish elections. And there's quite a marked difference. Here they're thinking, we can run a huge scare campaign. This is if you want Catalonia to stay in Spain, you must go out and vote. And that they think they can get that body of people who normally don't vote, to go out and vote. And the other thing they think they can do, and I hope they can do, is produce division in the pro-independence camp between the boycott position and the participation position. But that's all a big, it's all a bit of a gamble by Rajoy. And just on that El Mundo poll, the El Mundo poll wouldn't surprise me, but it's not a huge difference. I mean, they say a shift back to, a unionist relative majority as compared to a pro-independence relative majority. But the thing is so volatile that, a poll you ask one day, ask people one day what they think, and then you ask them 2 days later, they'll have changed their mind. That's because the political situation here is so volatile. It's just, it's very, very difficult to describe, because you go into a pub and nobody's talking about the football. Everybody is talking about politics. And you talk to people one day, then you come back and talk to them the next day, and they say, oh, I was thinking about it, and I've changed my mind on that.
Interesting, interesting. Dick Nichols, we're completely out of time. We'll stay with the story, obviously. It is, as you said, so dynamic. Shifting, people are shifting, people are changing. Very sort of a tempestuous situation. We've been joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He's the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
You're listening
Loud and Clear.
To the World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Longtime leader of the Kurdistan regional government, Masoud Barzani, has resigned following an independence referendum that prompted an Iraqi government offensive that retook the contested city of Kirkuk. Following clashes in the Kurdish parliament, what comes next for the KRG in Iraq? We're joined from Washington by Kani Zulam, founder of the American Kurdish Information Network, and we're also joined by Ali Mousawi. He's a war correspondent covering the war against Daesh in Iraq. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So the Western press, here in Washington especially, the Washington Post specifically, is saying that Barzani's resignation is a serious setback for Kurdish independence. I'm having trouble seeing any other position. Let's start with Kani. Can you tell us what's the background to these machinations?
The Kurdish struggle is not over. It just has entered another phase. Barzani is the third generation in the Kurdish fight for political space in the Middle East. His grandfather was hanged by Ottomans in Mosul. His father died in Washington in exile. He's still fighting. He has just resigned his post, and he says he will join the Peshmerga, the Kurdish freedom fighters, to protect the Kurdish political gains in Iraq.
Yes. Ali, what do you think? How is the Baghdad government going to respond to this, especially in light of the fact that that it's announced a ceasefire?
Well, it'll be difficult to judge what Baghdad would respond to this. I mean, the most we're hearing right now is there are people trying to restart negotiation between the central government and the Kurdish regional government led by Nursevan Barzani. We're still not sure if this is gonna materialize since Iraq has been insistent on going by the constitution, and they will not start negotiation unless the referendum results are rescinded. So we're still waiting on Baghdad to respond to that. But the resignation by Barzani, in one way or another, is an admittance of failure. He has promised independence. He has, and following the independence, the Kurdish region has lost so much of its autonomy, and he has been warned by even political parties here in the Kurdish region against going unilaterally, saying that it will backfire against a much more powerful regional countries and a stronger Iraq. And this is what seems to have happened.
Kani Zulam, help us understand the internal dynamic within Kurdish politics. I fully understand that your position here in Washington is an advocate of the Kurdish cause writ large. So I understand that. But just help understand some of the nuance, some of the subtlety, some of the things that would help our audience, which is trying to pay attention to the Middle East, but may not yet have sufficient information to understand what the internal dynamic is inside of the Kurdish regional government or among the political parties there.
Inside Kurdistan regional government, there are three parties. KDP is the largest one, followed by Goran, followed by PUK. All three, I mean, Goran is new, but PUK and KDP go back to 70s, and KDP goes back to 1946. They have basically fought central government. They have had progress, sometimes setbacks, sometimes genocide, sometimes chemical weapons used in Halabja and 200 and other places sometimes. Right now, the situation is very tense. Barzani resigned, and the parliament has been given some of his powers. The prime minister has been given some of the others, and the judiciary has been given some of the others, basically a division of the powers. But Nechirwan Barzani, the prime minister of Kurdistan regional government, he actually went to school in Tehran in Iran. He knows Farsi. He's apparently well-liked in Washington as well as in Baghdad. Let's hope that cooler heads will prevail. Iraq doesn't need another war. Middle East doesn't need another war. The constitution hasn't been implemented. The Kurds are not asking to dominate Arab Iraq or Baghdad or Hilla or Basra. It's the majority Arab population right now, a Shiite population that wants to dominate the Kurdish political space. Constitution, for example, said there has to be a referendum by 2007 in the disputed territories. The central government basically slept on it, and the reason is because there is oil under the soil of Kirkuk. In the last election in 2014, the province of Kirkuk elected 12 deputies. 8 of them are Kurds, 2 of them are Arabs, 2 of whom are Turkmen. In the last referendum that was held on September 25, majority of the province of Kirkuk voted to join the Kurdistan Regional Government. If Baghdad was respecting the rule of law, then Baghdad would have said, let's negotiate. Maybe I don't like your referendum. I'll have United Nations come and hold a referendum. But instead, Baghdad used force in post-Saddam Iraq. Saddam used to use force anytime he liked, anytime he wanted. And now Abadi has simply followed his example. And it's a bad example. And I don't think it's the end of the show. I think we are just entering a dangerous zone, a dangerous phase in the Arab body politics relative to the Kurds.
You know, Brian, the Kurds find themselves in a difficult position because of the neighborhood in which they live. None of the area governments supported the referendum. In fact, the only government of any note that did was the Israeli government, and they did that really just to be a thorn in the side of the Turks and the Iraqis and the Iranians. Iraqi Kurdistan has been described over the last decade or so as semi-autonomous. I wonder if there is a middle ground here where the Kurds can manage the oil fields and can be truly autonomous, although still working in a federated Iraq.
The Kurds are willing to share the oil wealth of Kirkuk with the rest of Iraq. I mean, what the Kurds want is a functioning constitution, like, for example, America has with the state of California. Each year, the state of California sends Washington about $350 billion in taxes, and each year, federal government sends about $340 billion in aid to federal state of California. The Kurds want a transparent constitution where they could, you know, they don't mind sharing the oil wealth of Kirkuk with the rest of Iraq, too. The rest of Iraq is pretty rich as well. But we have, unfortunately, you know, greedy politicians who think, you know, more land equals greatness, whereas justice equals greatness, whereas freedom equals greatness. But those things have unfortunately fallen by the wayside. And we have now, you know, the tense situation. For example, this morning, a journalist was hacked into, you know, at his house in the province of Kirkuk, because the tensions are so high, because people, you know, are afraid. 168,000 people left Kirkuk province to go to Sulaymaniyah, to go to Erbil. Why? Because they're afraid. If the central government was their government, if the central government respected the rule of law, these people wouldn't leave. They would say, okay, well, the central government took over. Hopefully they will respect my space. Hopefully they'll respect my civil liberties. But that's not what we have. And we need to go back to a post-Saddam Iraq where people are respected and accepted and their languages are respected and their cultures are respected. And we have to do away with this majority knows best.
Okay. I want to bring Ali back into the discussion. There's different issues when you listen to Kani Zulam's presentation. One is the right to separate. Of course, California, for instance, doesn't have the right to separate inside the United States. It's a federal system. It does have certain prerogatives, but it doesn't have control, say, over federal property, etc. You may make the argument that California gets about what it gives to the federal government in taxes, but a lot of states in the United States don't feel that. From your point of view, Ali, the Kurdish aspiration for independence or freedom is somewhat different from having a, quote, better deal or a better equality or a better share of things within Iraq. Where do you think this will end up? Will the other Kurdish parties, the non-Barzani parties, the not the KDP, become new partners with the central government in Baghdad?
If there is one thing that all Kurdish political parties agree on is that they all want independence. And that has been consistent regardless of how they want their independence in the Iraqi Kurdish region. They've all voiced their support for such idea. However, different parties have, have different concept of how they achieve their independence. Some want a functioning democracy in the region before such a move could take place, a functioning government, which we have seen over the past 2 years that is not so much in the Kurdish region at the moment. That's one thing. And the Kurdish region in accordance to the Iraqi constitution, does not have the right to separation. They do have part of the Iraqi constitution. It says that any region or any governorate have the right to ask for a referendum to be semi-autonomous, but not to be independent. That's in accordance to, so it's very similar to America, where they have no right to separation, but they also have the right to be independent. However, certain things come under the should be under the control of the central government or the federal government, such as in the U.S., where international airports and border crossing are controlled by the federal government. That's it's pretty much the same in Iraq. As for the financial side of things, it has been very difficult. I mean, corruption is high in Iraq, and that's in general, whether it's in the Kurdish region or in Baghdad. And no one can be sure where the money is going to go, whoever controls it, whether here or controls the the revenues from the oil exports. It's still not known where it's going, whether it's in the central government or in the Kurdish region. So that's another problem where the people have been promised so much in terms of independence and what it could achieve for the Kurdish region. Even during the past 2 years, when there have been relative independence from Baghdad, where the Kurdish region was selling oil and was financing everything on its own, not much was known about the money, where it's going. There's not much transparency. So it's not much different to the government in Baghdad, where transparency has been a big issue, and corruption as well. So while the promises have been there that life will improve, they have not been what people supported. I mean, that's one of the main reasons why people are pushing for such an idea, because they've been through so much previously that a lot of Kurdish people do not trust someone else to govern them. That's one of the main reasons why they are pushing for such an idea. But from what we have seen in the past 2 years is that the rule in the Kurdish region is pretty much the same as Baghdad. And it will be a long time before such an idea can actually materialize for the Kurdish region.
Kani Zulam, we have about 30 seconds left. Tell us very briefly what we should expect to see in the Kurdish parliament in the coming days. Now Masoud Barzani has stepped aside. We have the ceasefire with the central government in Baghdad. What's the next step?
Expectation on the part of the Kurdish parliament, as well as the Prime Minister Nashirwan Barzani, is that the United States would use its good offices to prevail over the Hashmi Shaabi, who's at the border of Kurdistan regional government, threatening with takeover of the Kurdish territory. And then that later the issue that Ali raises, corruption, nepotism. Unfortunately, it's both endemic, both in Baghdad and in Erbil. I'll grant him that. And hopefully, Abadi and Barzani, the junior, together with his deputy, Talabani Qubat, who used to live here and work here, will, raise Iraq to a better standard where it will be a functioning federal government where Kurds would feel at home, too.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
You're listening Loud and Clear. To the World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Another round of Syria peace talks convened by Russia, Iran, and Turkey are underway in Kazakhstan with delegates set to discuss the future of the country's four de-escalation zones. We are joined again from London by Peter Ford, former UK ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Ford, it's kind of interesting about these talks. And of course, this is not the first round of talks in Kazakhstan, but the U.S. is not a relevant player here. Talk about the talks and what they mean.
Well, I think the U.S. is trying to become a relevant player. They've upped the level of their attendance at these talks for the present round and the one before. We're now on the seventh round. But it's true that until now, the U.S. has been largely marginalized. What these talks essentially are about are holding the ring in Syria in four specific geographical zones, holding the situation stable in those areas so that the Syrian government forces can mop up ISIS and to some extent the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups while these areas are being held stable with ceasefires. These four areas include one on the Jordanian border in the south, and that's the one in which the U.S. is most involved, one on the outskirts of Damascus, and two in the north near the border with Turkey. And the real players here are Turkey, which has some influence with some of the opposition groups, Iran, which obviously has influence with the Syrian government, and Russia, likewise. And these three, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, are basically running the show with some smaller input from the U.S. and Jordan.
Ambassador Ford, I don't mean for this to sound like a rhetorical question, but it seems to me that isn't this an example of diplomacy actually working? Isn't this an example of how a use of force is not always necessary, that it's better to sit at a table and actually work out these issues?
Well, that's absolutely right. And I dare say some of the inhabitants of these four zones who are benefiting from a much-needed respite after 6 years of incessant warfare, I think some of these inhabitants might believe that Russia, as the leader of, and instigator of these talks, deserves a commendation for the Nobel Peace Prize. This is how diplomacy should work.
You know, Brian Becker, I used to complain when I was at the CIA during the George W. Bush administration that I had never seen an administration work so hard to not talk to its enemies. And it seems like it's become the norm in American politics that diplomacy ought to always take a backseat to military affairs. And here we have a situation where without the United States, countries like Iran and Jordan and Turkey and Russia and Syria are all sitting at the negotiating table together, and they're actually making progress.
I don't think it's an accident that the U.S. is leading on the military foot rather than the diplomatic foot. I mean, let's go back these last 25 years. There was that infamous white paper that the New York Times published that the George H.W. Bush administration said wasn't real, but in fact it was real, and it really represented a consensus opinion, which is that post-Cold War, post-Soviet era, that the United States would make sure to lead with its military. In other words, use its extraordinary military superiority to send a message to the rest of the world, we will brook no rivals. Don't think that there's going to be a change, that we are the dominant player. And thus they've relied on military over and over again. Iraq, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan. And of course, it's kind of a fantasy because the world isn't simply drawn out on a battlefield where the number one dominant military force always wins, as if it's just a simulation game. Ambassador Ford, talk about the dynamics about why the U.S. policy is, as John Kiriakou said, mainly leading with the military rather than the diplomatic.
Well, one of the main reasons is that the United States doesn't talk to Iran, doesn't talk to Syria, to obviously main players, and has fractious relations with Russia, which is a main player. So U.S. diplomacy is tying itself hand and foot before the game even starts. And in an arena like Syria, where the U.S. is hesitant to deploy full military power for obvious reasons, it would be a quagmire. It finds itself relatively weak on the military front and relatively weak on the diplomatic front.
Yeah, John, it seems to me that when you look back at things, perhaps it was hubris or arrogance, a failure to estimate the relationship of forces following what happened in Libya, where you took a small country, 5 million plus people, Libya, a government that, you know, was able to be toppled after a fairly short NATO air war. And then I think the U.S. had the bit in its mouth and said, okay, it worked there. Let's do it again in Syria, except Syria is not Libya.
And another problem, Brian, is that, and I witnessed this through my entire career in federal service, and that is that we always think that we're the smartest people in the room. We always think that we know better than everybody else. We're better informed than any other diplomats around the world or governmental leaders around the world, and that no one is as smart as we are. There's a famous quote. I hope it's not apocryphal, but I actually typed it and printed it and posted it above my desk. It's a quote from Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he said, "The thing about you Americans is that you always make complicated, stupid decisions. You don't make clear-cut, stupid decisions, which makes us wonder if there's something to them which we are missing." And it was my experience that we do make very complicated, stupid decisions, and it's because we think we're smarter than everybody else. I think that the Syria situation now, where we're seeing forward movement and momentum in diplomacy, proves that we are not always right.
Ambassador Ford, go ahead.
Yeah, I concur with all of that. And it doesn't stop. Just the other day, Secretary Tillerson said there was no place for Assad in a future Syria. Well, what arrogance, what condescension. Who's he to say? Whatever one may think of Assad, it's the Syrian people, not the U.S. secretary. And anyway, he's spitting in the wind there. Everybody knows that Assad is not going to be dislodged any time soon. And then in the same breath, Secretary Tillerson said that Iran deserved no credit for any of the mopping up of ISIS, which we've witnessed in the last few months in Syria. I'm afraid the U.S. secretary is in denial. This is a matter of established fact that the Iranian militias have played an important military role. He's just in denial.
I also thought it was interesting that Tillerson said about Iraq that all foreign troops needed to get out of the country.
Yeah, except ours. Yeah.
Except ours.
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, it's arrogant and it's ironic and it's funny. Except, as John Kiriakou said, Ambassador Ford, the U.S. always says it's right, even when its policies have obviously led to a catastrophe, mainly a catastrophe for the people in the targeted countries where the suffering is taking place. But it seems to me also that no one's ever held to account for catastrophic mistakes. Just the power of the U.S. empire is such that no one's called to account. And as a consequence, it's sort of a costless mistake. In other words, nobody has to really think too hard about it when they go on to make more and more mistakes. Anyway, it seems to me to be part of the dynamic here. Ambassador Ford, let's talk about what's going on specifically at the talks in Kazakhstan. In addition to the de-escalation zones, there's talks about prisoner exchanges between the various sides. What do you think will happen on that front?
Well, this is encouraging that it's at least on the agenda. It's a very important issue for the armed opposition, because essentially what's being discussed here are terms of surrender. Assad has won, the opposition has lost. Gradually, they're getting down to talking about terms of surrender. So in this end game, the agenda now turns to details like exchange of prisoners, release of detainees. It's extremely important for the families involved and to some extent public opinion in the in the areas still occupied by the rebels matters quite a lot. This is why they're so keen to make progress on this issue of the detainees. There's another humanitarian issue on the agenda, and that's demining. This is particularly important to the Syrian government because it's an essential part of future stabilization.
Ambassador Ford, the United Nations is participating in these talks. Can you tell us what exactly their role is and what you expect it to be?
I think their role at this particular round is limited mainly to discussing the modalities of demining. The UN has expertise in this area, and being more neutral than most possible alternatives, I think the participants are turning to these specialized UN agencies for help in this area, possibly also with provision of food for besieged areas. Essentially, it's a technical participation. The UN is also holding its own round of talks. Let us not forget the Geneva series of talks, the next of which is due to take place on the 28th of November. These are going nowhere fast. These are on about their sixth round. They have a quite unrealistic set of ambitions. They are officially about a transition in Syria, which kind of presupposes that the rebels have won, when in fact the incumbent has won. And the only transition from Bashar al-Assad will be to more Bashar al-Assad.
Last question. We have about 60 seconds left. The U.S. is fighting alongside Syrian Democratic Forces, really the Kurds. What happens to the Kurds now? What happens to Kurdistan within Syria?
Ultimately, a measure of autonomy. The Kurds are strong enough militarily to negotiate hard, play some hardball with the Syrian government, which has said it's ready in principle to negotiate a measure of self-rule. And this will almost certainly happen.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from London by Peter Ford, former UK ambassador to Syria. After we take a short break, we will be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
You're listening Loud and Clear. To the World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Some of the most revealing documents in the JFK files were, in fact, about Cuba. Evidence has now emerged from these files that the U.S. government was considering biological warfare on Cuban agriculture and a staged bombing campaign inside the United States that would be blamed on the Cuban government, among other schemes. We are joined from London by Dr. Helen Yaffe. She is an economic history fellow at the London School of Economics and the author of the book Che Guevara, The Economics of Revolution. Welcome back, Helen.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me again.
So, John Kiriakou, I mean, you were there in the CIA, not there then, not in 1960 and 61. In some ways, this is the most startling part about the documents. Not that they're startling in the sense that they're a surprise, but they go into great detail about what the CIA and the U.S. government was willing to do.
Well, you know, Brian, to me, one of the most startling things is that after all these years and all the decades of jokes about the CIA trying to send Castro exploding cigars, for example, or to slather poison on the wheel of his on the steering wheel of his car, what we're talking about here are real crimes. I mean, not only is it a crime to assassinate someone, but these were serious international crimes. They're talking about biological warfare against Cuban agriculture. They're talking about planting bombs around Miami and using it as a false flag to blame the Cubans. You're talking about crimes that could have resulted in the deaths of many, many people, not just Cubans, but Americans as well. This isn't funny. This isn't a joke. This is something that's a very important revelation, I believe.
Yeah, Helen, go ahead.
Well, I agree, but I would just like to point out that the proposals that were made in this meeting and the information that's been revealed at a specific moment in time, those proposals may not have been pursued. But let's be clear that all sorts of tactics, including biological warfare against Cuba, have been used. The Cubans have a very detailed case where they, you know, give the details of over 3,400 people who have been killed in Cuba by similar bans and acts of terrorism launched from the United States, either with support or at least, you know, cognizance from the US administration. So, I mean, we need to be clear about that. For example, in the early 1980s, Cuba had a sudden and very violent outbreak of a specific form of dengue fever. This was a strain of dengue which had never been seen in the Western Hemisphere before and suddenly appeared in Cuba. And the Cubans were pretty direct and pretty quick to point to the CIA and US authorities. And it was categorically denied at that point. You can see the State Department says, oh, this is a ridiculous accusation. But in fact, a very technical scientific investigation was carried out in Cuba, and last results were published, which gave evidence that the dengue fever, this particular strain, must have been introduced from laboratories in the United States. And that dengue outbreak led to the death of 180 people. 101 of them were children.
Yeah, when we look at the documents, you know now why the CIA didn't want these documents released. It's not because there's necessarily a smoking gun about JFK and the assassination, but it is about CIA crime, certainly, minimally. And there are other documents that the CIA has not released that the Trump administration backed away from releasing at the last moment. I want to read one paragraph from the documents. This is a CIA quote: "We could sink a boatload of Cubans en route to Florida, real or simulated. We could foster attempts on lives of Cuban refugees in the United States, even to the extent of wounding in instances to be widely publicized. Quote: exploding a few plastic bombs in carefully chosen spots, the arrest of a Cuban agent, and the release of prepared documents substantiating Cuban involvement also would be helpful in projecting the idea of an irresponsible government." So, you know, John and Helen, when people are dismissing people who say this or that might be a false flag attack, here we have documents showing the CIA is prepared to sink a boatload of Cuban immigrants who it says it cares about their lives, and willing to plant some plastic bombs and say, hey, the Cuban government did that.
You know, isn't it a shame that our government even considered doing things like this? It's so easy to dismiss people who talk about false flags as people on the fringe of American politics or people who don't understand international politics. Well, in fact, the reason so many people believe in conspiracy theories is because those conspiracy theories actually were conspiracies at some point. So, you know, I blame our government. When you see documents like those that were just released that Helen is talking about right now, it makes you think that sometimes we really are the bad guys in international affairs. I think this kind of proves it, at least in this snapshot in time.
Helen, keep going. Let's talk more about the CIA or the U.S. government's support for terrorist actions. There were a number of bombs that went off in Cuban tourist hotels when Cuban's tourism business was starting to take off. That was not in 1961 or 62. That was in the late 1990s. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. That was in 1997. It took place just in the months before Cuba hosted the World Festival of Students, of Youth and Students in Havana. And those were bombs planted in hotels, as you said. And that was a master plan of very well-known, infamous Cuban exile terrorist, Luis Posada Carriles. This is a man who, you know, lives freely in Miami, who has admitted to a New York journalist his role in the hotel bombs. It's just extraordinarily fortunate that they didn't claim more victims, as it was one Italian tourist was killed. But one of the bombs, either in or next to the workers' creche in that hotel, and it was just where that particular bomb exploded, it was just sheer coincidence that the children weren't there. So, you know, I mean, just look at the numbers, you know, over 3,400 Cubans killed as a result of these acts of terrorism launched from the United States. Another 2,800 permanently maimed in some way and disabled. Well, really, I guess for people outside the United States, your comments about, you know, I guess somehow, you know, maybe we are the bad guys, that's quite a shocking comment to us, because especially, you know, as a historian of Latin America, I mean, there can be no doubt about the role that the United States has played in using any manner of tactics to force its own agenda, its agenda of, you know, having Latin America as its backyard, as its sphere of influence, as a source of the resources that it needs for its own industrial development and so on. You know, just look at Operation Condor that happened not long after the release of these documents in the 1970s, which was in some way supported or coordinated by U.S. authorities, and it was the military regimes in South America. And, you know, estimates of how many people were disappeared or murdered in various, over all those countries throughout that period under Operation Condor add up to something like, you know, 400,000 people. So, you know, these are real victims of a U.S. Agenda. You know, this is hard power at play.
Helen, you're exactly right. Part of the problem here in the States is that Americans don't learn about this history in our schools. There are no textbooks in our public schools that are going to teach our school children about the Allende overthrow, for example, or U.S. support for military dictatorships in Argentina or Brazil or elsewhere around the continent. We have to rely either on Hollywood, frankly, with films like Missing, or on our own research and analysis as we become adults. It's really a problem here.
Just to qualify my comment, I mean, I feel like it's my responsibility to say that the situation is similar in Britain in terms of Britain's own history. So students in Britain learn very little about some of the, you know, the most brutal and horrific aspects of the British Empire. For example, the famine that was orchestrated by the British in India. So I think that is, you know, to understand how that happens, we have to understand how institutions such as education and civil society reflect the sort of predominant economic interests of any country, really.
Helen, I was at the trial of Luis Posada Carriles in Texas, and you're right, he's in Miami. He came, even though he had been wanted, and Venezuela had an extradition order for him during the Chavez government period. I think it might still remain, because Luis Posada Carriles and his cohorts helped to shoot down a civilian airliner in midair. It had the Cuban Olympic fencing team and others. I think more than 70 people were killed when they set off the bomb midair. I mean, you know, we have such a thing about airplanes and terrorism. Well, here the CIA operatives, Luis Posada Carriles and his cohorts, did that. Everybody on the plane was killed. That was October 6, 1976. And yet he's walking free in Miami. And he came in during the Obama administration, originally arrested, but then set free. Why this kind of blank check for people who commit terrorist acts?
Well, I think precisely because the kind of files that have been released over the weekend revealing the kind of operations the CIA either considered or were involved in, that's the information he has. I mean, I don't know whether he has the documentary evidence, but that's the kind of operations he was involved in. And it's quite clear that some sort of trade-off has been done, and he has made himself untouchable by saying, you know, I will reveal what I did and what I was involved in on behalf of the U.S. government through the CIA. He was a CIA operative.
Helen, these CIA documents show that the U.S. government was trying to create disease and kill Fidel Castro. They were trying to contaminate a skin-diving outfit. There's a lot of talk inside of Venezuela and inside of Latin America that Hugo Chavez, the leader of Venezuela, who suddenly got sick with cancer and pretty quickly died, that he may have been the target of a CIA operation. Of course, that's just a theory right now, but it has a lot of traction in Latin America. What do you think of it?
Well, I don't want to, you know, speculate. I haven't seen the evidence, but there's certainly some experts in Venezuela, people who follow the relationship with the United States between the US and Venezuela very closely, who have come out and said, you know, we're pretty confident that Chavez's death wasn't due to natural causes, and that all the assistance he was getting from Cuban medical professionals, who are among the best in the world, were coming up against a brick wall, and there was some sort of persistence of his ailment. But, I mean, I think we have to be clear that U.S. history has shown, even with its domestic citizens, look at the way it treated the Black Panther Party, look at its COINTELPRO, its counterintelligence program that was used in the 1960s and actually secretly carried on after it was exposed and supposed to have been ended. And you can see that they will take many, many measures in order to regain control when they feel that they're losing it.
Well, that's all the time we have. We want to thank Helen Yaffe for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. In the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, 4 to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, at 105.5 FM and at SputnikNews.com. And you can subscribe at iTunes Podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.